When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name's Mike Calvin. I'm joined by Dominic Fifield of The Guardian and John Cross of The Daily Mirror. Don't look now, but Manchester City are odds on to win the Premier League next season. Let's get this season out of the way, shall we? City, worthy champions, had worthy challengers in Liverpool. Now they seek a treble at Watford's expense in the FA Cup final on Saturday. Can't really bet against them, can you, Dom?
No, you can't. And even post-match yesterday at the Amex Stadium, talking to players and when Pep Guardiola came in and spoke to us, they're already talking about the FA Cup final. They're already talking about this unprecedented domestic treble. And actually, they're already talking about and mentioning constantly the fact that there's still disappointment that they went out of the Champions League at the stage they did. So the levels of perfectionism within that squad, driven by the manager... Well, they will demand that they go out there at Wembley next weekend and secure that trophy, and they can look back on this season with some real satisfaction. Mm.
It's a real no-limits strategy, isn't it, John?
Absolutely.
Driven.
Absolutely. I thought that, honestly, my favourite quote amidst all the celebration and you know, deserved adulation for their brilliant season. They've been unbelievable. I think it's been by far and away the best title race in the Premier League era, and that I would argue makes them the best champions of the Premier League, I think, in history. I really do. But the best quote, I thought, really came right at the end of Guardiola's press conference, when he said basically he was asked for any weaknesses in his squad. Mm. And he said, yes, there are plenty of weaknesses. And we all looked in astonishment. Where? And basically he's then come back and the sort of the person that asked the question and said, well, at set pieces. From set pieces, I go in the dressing room and I'm the tallest person amongst my players. It's not enough, basically. And then he said, when we defend set pieces, I have to go to the church and pray. I mean, it's a brilliant quote. It's absolutely wonderful. But it summed up, I think, actually a very valid point, because I think Fernandinho, who's been absolutely phenomenal for them in the last couple of seasons, but he has suffered with injuries this season, and he clearly is getting on with age, and I guess they will need someone, I think, to replace him. So, a big commanding, perhaps, you know, a sort of a tall midfielder who sort of then doubles up in sort of defending set pieces. A centre-half. I mean, blimey, Laporte has been phenomenal in my view. Absolutely fantastic defender. But what's Kompany going to do next? It would appear to me that maybe Kompany's going to move on. I don't know.
Can't you see him staying at the club in some capacity?
I hope so, Mike. But I do think that he's been very clear, Kompany, isn't he, that he wants to carry on playing. So he's basically saying, there's no way I'm retiring. We'll see what comes of it. I just think his value in the last few weeks, like you, has shown to me that he's got something beyond his playing days. Mm-hmm. Fabulous ambassador, fabulous servant for Man City. Will they, you know, bearing in mind how well he's played recently, will they think about giving him one more year? I'd like to think so. Stones has been in and out, hasn't he? Mm. Maybe there's a new sort of challenge lying ahead for Otamendi. Just makes me think, I think they'll sign, you know, that holding midfield player with some height and also another really strong, physically powerful centre-half, because I think if you got one of those alongside Laporte, I think it would be arguably make up the best, you know, sort of central defensive partnership in the Premier League. I know I'm being really picky here because I think they've been fabulous. Mm. But I do think that Guardiola, the reason he's so good, the reason he's so successful, is that basically when he wins something, he wants to push on again. Mm. And that's what I think. Retaining the title marks you down as the hallmark of brilliant champions, the best there, but also wanting to improve every year. And that is why Guardiola, for me, is the best coach in the world.
I suspect they'll try and improve on David Silva as well. I mean, it's hard to do, and he's been a great of the Premier League era and one of the most amazing signings that Manchester City have made. But I look at him now, and although there was a touch of class always in everything he does, I wonder whether he's got a year left to go and this might be the time to get somebody in to give them a period of adjustment at the club as well so that they can take up the mantle left by David Silva when he departs the Etihad as well. But Crossy's right. They're all about improving. They're all about building on success. And you could argue that, you know, in the past, maybe one of the reasons we haven't had back-to-back title winners for a decade is that teams sort of rest on their laurels. I mean, look at Chelsea every time they win the Premier League title.
They take a year off, don't
they? Yeah, and they never build upon it anymore. They used to, but they don't anymore. And I think City are the type of club now that will carry on building and building.
Because with that relentlessness, Dom, you know, I think one of the many stats that was thrown around in the aftermath of that win at Brighton, Pep's got an overall 82% win record. Mm. In his 10 years as a manager. Mm. Now, OK, you can say he's at the best clubs, but are we looking at someone who, in essence, is City's Ferguson?
I don't think Pep will have the longevity of a Ferguson. Mm. I don't think he would want to do that. I think we saw with Bayern Munich, he gets to the stage where he needs to move on. He might even need a break just to recharge his batteries, because look at the intensity of the man. I mean, even before the game yesterday, he did his usual thing where he came out to the dugouts and sat there. I was out about an hour before kickoff, and it was before the players had come out,
because those dugouts are very close to the
press box, just in front of the press box. And he was sitting there on his own. He did a few sort of selfies with some of the fans, which was nice, and he warmed him to the locals. But then he went and sat there in his seat, and his foot was jiggling up and down. It was an agitation to him. He was obviously a bit nervous, and he was just surveying the scene. You just look at it. The man was already completely engulfed in what the occasion was going to be about. And, you know, he'd done all his preparation. His players must have known what they had to go out and do. But it consumes him. And it must get to the stage where he just needs a little breather just to recharge his batteries and then see where he goes again. It's not now. I mean, he suggested post-match as well that he needs that time to recharge. Mm. And the intensity of a season does take it out of him. But it's not yet, because there's still work to be done at City. There's still a third Premier League title in a row. There's still the Champions League. There's still stuff that he needs to achieve at City before he's satisfied.
Yeah. You know, just to clarify that point about the 82%, I wasn't talking about a win record, which would be absurd when you think about it, but it was actually 82% of the points available that he's taken. Yeah, amazing. So in that, if we're looking at the battle of the managers or whatever you want to call it, compare and contrast Pep with Jurgen Klopp.
I think the one thing that really strikes me through this incredible battle, and it has been sort of toe-to-toe, is the respect shared between the two managers. I do think they clearly play differently, I think, in that basically Liverpool are so much more of a pressing team, I think. And don't get me wrong, City are obviously clearly very good at that themselves. But I think the energy that they expend into playing that way, I think everyone could see that, and it was brilliantly illustrated last week at Anfield. But I do think they're incredibly tight and close, and I think Klopp, his connection with players is crucial. His connection with the fans. That's not to say that he's not, you know, Guardiola's not adored, but I do think that sort of Klopp feeds on that energy from indeed Anfield, and you know, the Liverpool fans generally. Mm. But I do feel that at times you get the sense that the players would run through brick walls for Klopp. And that's the sort of momentum that he builds from having those connections. I think that probably Guardiola might be better tactically. And I think that the way he builds play can make City, I think, slightly more attractive to watch, although Liverpool completely, I think, at times blow you away. Mm. What I'm trying to say is that basically, ultimately, I think they're very, very similar, both in style and in stature. But I think right now Guardiola does have a little bit of an edge on Klopp. He needed to kind of take City on, and basically, after, I mean, I'm sorry, but it's clear for all to see that Liverpool, the turning point in this title race was the Merseyside derby. Because that was the day that Liverpool, during a spell when they weren't playing at their absolute best, it was a 0-0 draw, and that was the day that basically dropping points meant that it was back in City's hands. And until that point, then basically it was in Liverpool's hands. And then from then on, City, midway through that period, they've been on a 14-game winning run to clinch the title. That was the standard set by Liverpool, and saying that's what you'll need to do. And I think I go back to that point about the respect that it is clear between the two managers. And I think that basically, if you go back through it, they've not once criticised each other. I don't think there's been little, you know, pokes, but not on a, you know, a previous sort of scale of mind games or kind of, you know, really sort of ugly spat or anything like that. I think there's genuine respect, because I do think the guys in many ways are very similar. I do think Pep still maintains a slight edge at the moment.
Yeah. Is Klopp, say, more empathetic? And that probably suits a club like Liverpool, where essentially they turn their star players into heroes, don't they? Folk heroes. Yeah. Whereas Manchester City, it's almost more machine-like. And I don't say that in any sort of disrespectful way. It's actually the individual is... Yeah. Subjected to the collective.
And Guardiola acknowledged that yesterday. He said that we don't have somebody who's going to necessarily dribble past five players and score a wonder goal and maybe do that 15, 20 times a season. They have amazing players in virtually every position. Well, actually, in every position. I mean, the team and squad at City is mouthwatering, but it is very much about the collective. You're right, it's a machine. And it's a machine that has been set up to work the Guardiola way. It just clicks, but it didn't at first. But it's taken its time to sort of calibrate it to work in this way. But it now is a machine in Guardiola's own in image. Yeah. And I think they're both at the right clubs. I mean, Klopp is perfect for Liverpool for the sort of feverish passion that comes from that club. I mean, we've all seen it in European nights, but we've seen it over the course of a Premier League season now. As well, but City, we should acknowledge perhaps that City did it this season, 98 points, held off that challenge, despite Fernandinho's absence with injuries quite regularly, despite De Bruyne being out for 20 games through injury.
He was their best player last year.
Yeah, absolutely, and they've still maintained the standards. Even without. I know Mahrez scored a wonderful goal yesterday, but he was their one major addition last summer. And he's, what's it, fourth Premier League start of the calendar year yesterday. So he's not made perhaps the impact that you normally, a £60 million player, would expect to make in a team. So it is hugely impressive. I feel sorry for that Liverpool's season hasn't yielded that trophy, because they have been exceptional. It's just that City were that bit more exceptional in the final count.
Well, they've got the Champions League final, as we well know, haven't we? There's an interesting, another comparison between the clubs. They're the goalkeepers. Edison, 20 clean sheets. Alisson at Liverpool, 21. Now, Dave Priest, late of this parish, now in freezing somewhere north of here. He basically saying that Edison's probably his goalkeeper of the season. Mm. What do you think?
I'd probably agree, yeah. I do think Alisson has made a world of difference to Liverpool. Mm. I know that's probably the most obvious thing you'll hear, you know, but because we've gone from Karius to Alisson. And I think Alisson is a bigger goalkeeper, isn't he? Fills the goal more. I mean, sometimes I look at Edison and I think, blimey, how tall is he again? Because he can look sort of almost like... You know, sort of when he doesn't fill the goal, he looks like a pint-sized midfielder. He can certainly play in midfield. And I think that Alisson is the more commanding goalkeeper. And he has been something of a revelation for Liverpool. I mean, blimey, how often do we see a goalkeeper arrive and he's just not... I mean, maybe he sort of kind of had one mess up at Leicester, if you remember that one.
Yeah, the Cruyff turn.
Absolutely. Yeah. But then, really... It's a phenomenal achievement for a foreign goalkeeper to arrive in English football for a huge fee and then not to suffer any sort of degree of criticism. That shows his quality, because I think we tend to look at goalkeepers, sort of in the English press, far more acutely than perhaps some of our counterparts abroad. I don't know, I might be wrong. It's just, you know, I look at the sort of the foreign press quite a lot, and I don't think they do sort of put them under a microscope quite as much as we do. But I just feel that Ederson might just shade it simply because he's so good on the ball that, as I say, that he can play out. You know, can he? I mean, Alisson, I think, was responsible for some fantastic saves. But I think Ederson is that bit more comfortable. Perhaps his lower sense of gravity is sort of kind of defines that. But he begins attacks. He never panics.
Yeah.
And he never gets caught on the ball. It's remarkable.
But they're right for their respective clubs as well. I mean, Ederson does fit into the system. Mm. He's exactly what Pep Guardiola is. And he also arrived in English football and just hit the ground running. And last season was sensational. This season just as good. But Alisson, I mean, look at Alisson against Barcelona last week. We sort of forget that. I mean, it's the goals at the other end. But, I mean, he pulled off some sensational saves in that game. And he almost does it unnoticed because we're drawn to Salah, we're drawn to Mane at the other end of the pitch. And he has been brilliant in his own way. And for Liverpool, not only have they turned a 25-point deficit into a one-point deficit in a season, but they've also become the stingiest defence in the division.
Yeah.
I think they've won better than City, 21 goals conceded. Look back and remember the laughing stock that Liverpool's back line was not that long ago. And now they're the best out there.
Mm.
Says it all. It wasn't quite enough, but it says it all.
Yeah, well, if you're talking about laughing stocks, you think about Manchester United, and it's really sobering. Only 2 clean sheets at home this season, fewest of anyone in the Premier League. That tells you a lot, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It is. Yeah, they're just, I don't know what's happened there, but it's been that sort of, you know, breakdown at United. But it just shows you that sort of kind of your home form, your home results are the base of everything, doesn't it, really? I mean, it's just, you know, Anfield has become a fortress.
And sometimes the goalkeeper is only as good as the people in front of him, isn't
it? Yeah, definitely. And I think yeah, De Gea has been horribly exposed. I mean, I still think we think if you are asked a straight question, who's the best goalkeeper in the world? I think the kind of natural reflex answer is basically you say David De Gea. We've got it on sort of almost, you know, auto cue. It's in the subliminal, you know, it's in your subconscious. But I have to say, it's been a bad year. And when I say that, it's been a bad sort of 12 months in that basically I think the build-up to the World Cup, he was flawless. I remember people saying that after he had a really good game at Watford really early in the season, or, you know, this proves he's the world's number one. Well, it doesn't. It really doesn't. If you've been watching him, you know, and then through the World Cup, his star has fallen. And I think that he is the ultimate shot stopper. He's the ultimate reflex goalkeeper. He's also the ultimate goal line goalkeeper, if you see what I mean. Because his reflexes are phenomenal. And he will still have amazing performances, like against Tottenham at Wembley. But I do think that the art of goalkeeping has evolved, and I felt for a long time Hugo Lloris was the best of both worlds. So he was the sweeper keeper, really good with his feet, and a fantastic goalkeeper, which I still think he is. He's won the World Cup, so we can't be that bad, but he's not quite as good as he was. And I just think that there's still room for improvement for Ederson and Alisson, who are on the upward scale, whereas I think David De Gea is playing like a goalkeeper who, his style of goalkeeping is going out of fashion, but I also think he's perhaps got his mind elsewhere.
But you couldn't, I mean, David De Gea couldn't play like Ederson or Alisson because he's not going to give the ball to Phil Jones or Chris Smalling or even Victor Lindelof. He's and expect them to sort of be able to get out of a press or whatever. He just looks like a goalkeeper that was brilliant and was single-handedly keeping a team afloat. And then it has to become a point where the inadequacies of everybody else around him, he's going to suffer.
I mean, he wears you down.
Yeah, it's got to. It's got to. And once the confidence suffers, then he won't be at that stellar level anymore. But I'm sure he'll get it back. I mean, he's an absolute, he's a brilliant goalkeeper still.
Yeah, yeah. Staying on that goalkeeping theme, Dom, with Watford, FA Cup final, is an FA Cup final the time and place for sentiment? I'm thinking in terms of, do Watford go with their heart, which would be to keep Aurelio Gomez, or their head, which would be to say, well, Ben Foster probably has been our number one, he should play in the final?
Yeah, it's an awkward one, especially when you've gone through the entire tournament or, you know, cup competition playing one man. Mm. And I mean, look, if I was a manager, I'd want to go with my strongest team. And Ben Foster is the better goalkeeper at the moment. But I can sort of see the sentiment. Look, on his day, Gomez is still excellent. But I think Foster gives you a better chance of repelling what is likely to be a barrage at Wembley again from Manchester City. They are sort of romantic occasions, aren't they? FA Cup finals. And maybe the romance of the competition dictates your selection policy on the day. I mean, logically speaking, you go with your strongest lineup.
Mm. It is difficult, you know, not to be influenced by a player's personality. Mm. Gomez is a lovely guy. Mm. You know, here's someone who's going to retire at the end of the season, become a pastor, you know, a man of great moral codes. But as a goalkeeper, sometimes he's like a frog in a blender, isn't he? He's all over the place.
Absolutely.
What would you do?
Oh, I'd go Foster all day long. Forget sentiment. Sorry, it's gone. You're at Wembley, you want to win a trophy. I honestly, down the years, it's driven me to distraction. I've watched a lot of Arsenal down the years. And Arsene Wenger was incredibly loyal to his number two goalkeeper who played in the Cups. Mm. And honestly, I mean, it's just been remarkable how, you know, in fairness, in years gone by, I think he did sort of kind of, through the rounds, even in one season, left out Seaman, but brought Seaman back for the final. But then in more recent times, he's rotated it between, and then I think there was one season when I think even Wojciech Szczesny was sort of ostracised from the first team, but then brought back for the cup final. No one could quite believe it.
Who would you play in Baku then?
But then, you know, more recently, you've had Cech and Ospina.
Yeah.
And then basically, he's basically gone for Ospina, who I've always felt needed a stepladder to reach the crossbar. And like, Cech is one of the all-time greats. This was we went and saw Petr Cech last week and did sort of interviewed him. And basically, this was the great irony about our conversation, was that Petr Cech registered his biggest frustration, his biggest disappointment from his time at Arsenal was that he signed for Arsenal in the hope of not only trying to help them win the Premier League, and he thought 2016 was the best chance, but almost I felt that it was almost more important to him in the way that he said, was that basically I would help them improve on a European stage. And then he basically said, after all that, I get there and they don't play me in the Champions League. I mean, it was just incredible. And then it goes round full circle. He's lost his status now, perhaps, as Arsenal number one, and burned Leno. Is first choice. I have to say, I think that I wouldn't have a problem, and in fact, I probably would go with Cech in the Europa final, simply because I don't know whether you saw this stat yesterday, but basically I think Bernardino has finished the season with the joint top number of mistakes that directly led to a goal. Mm. I think Bernardino will be a very good goalkeeper in the future, but for me, they're on level pegging. Whereas I don't think, and in fact, I'm a big Czech, you know, fan, so I'd probably arguably sort of still have him for experience and quality slightly higher than Leno, but that's personal choice. Don't have an issue with him playing. But I think that basically Foster and Gomez, sorry, but I totally agree with you, Mike, that then he is prone to error, Gomez, and I'd go Foster all day long.
You know, we'll acknowledge the difficulty of the task, let's put it like that, but how and why can Watford win that game? Midfield, for instance?
Yeah, Doucouré and Kapu. Deeney can, on his day, can ruffle the best defenders out there, ruffle them up. They have got power through that team. And, well, actually, you could go back to the snap of Delafoe's right ankle and that glorious first goal, wasn't it, at Wembley in the semi-final. When you've got a player that is capable of doing that and has a right foot that is capable of doing that, then you've always got a chance. However, they're going to have to defend phenomenally well. They don't have a great record against City generally in recent seasons. But, you know, it's an FA Cup final. Mm. Things can happen and strange things can happen, but they'll have to all play at the top of their game. I mean, you need Doucouré back to the best that he was showing earlier in the season with stampeding across midfield, you know, showing City what they're missing when in Fernandinho's absence, really. And Capoue has to snap into some of the challenges that I've been complaining about for most of this season. But he has to do that on this occasion if they're going to stand a chance, because they have to unsettle City to have a chance of winning.
Mm. I find Deeney a fascinating character because of his background, prison, and the way he's rehabilitated himself. Never short of a quote, which is brilliant. As a striker, probably not quite of the highest quality, but you know, a very good standard. His leadership. If you look around the Premier League, who are the natural leaders? Well, you could probably talk about Kompany. You could probably talk about Henderson at Liverpool. Connor Cody at Wolves, perhaps. But he's a natural leader, it seems to me, or an emotional leader of that team.
Yeah, I think, you know, if everyone sort of, you know, one person sort of typified what Watford are about, and he's their talisman as well. I mean, he's the sort of kind of... He's the one that sort of typifies that kind of underdog spirit, the battling through adversity, perhaps almost unfashionable, as indeed Watford are, let's be honest, a little bit as compared to some of their, you know, their sort of rivals. But I think that's not a criticism in any way. It's just basically being a little bit realistic about it. I think he doesn't suffer fools gladly. I think he's kind of, you know, rough and rugged and a bit sort of, you know, rough around the edges as well. But, I personally don't think he's ever really been particularly close to sort of the England shout. And I don't know whether that's kind of... I don't know whether that's fair or not, because I think at times he's probably been, you know, sort of as a classic centre-forward. And I have to say, that's not the way England play, is it?
No.
That's the biggest thing. They don't play that way. And then also sometimes, I guess his character, because he's so loud and demonstrative, I think sometimes it feels as if, you know, Southgate is so concerned about players, about sort of not wanting to upset the kind of the dynamic in the dressing room, that he doesn't give them a call. I mean, that was certainly the case for sort of Jonjo Shelvey, for example. But I also think that maybe he's thought, well, Deeney is such a powerful influence, if you see what I mean. Do I need that? I think that's probably been quite... I think it's been harsh on Deeney, is what I'm trying to say, that he's not had an England call. Because in other eras, in other spells, I think arguably he would. And I'm sure that would give him, you know, a great deal of pride. But he's been so good for Watford. And there's been times, I think, in the last couple of years, at various stages, where I think they've probably looked at moving him on.
Yeah.
I don't think that's unfair to sort of say that, but each time he's come back and proved them wrong. You know, he's maybe his sort of star waned under Matarazzi, and I don't think that basically he was sort of flavour of the month then, and, you know, maybe he was, again, he sort of kind of spoke out quite a lot then, didn't he, and sort of upset the apple cart, shall we say, amongst the hierarchy. And yet, actually, I think all his points have been proved right, really. So I think he's a hell of a leader, and he's a hell of a person, I think, for some of those Watford players to look up to and respond, because they are a sort of a mix and match sort of sort of team.
Well, the nature of the sort of business plan makes sure, you know, people don't stay there a long time, do they? Another leader that probably emerged last week was Harry Kane, even though he wasn't playing in Amsterdam. Do you expect him to play in Madrid?
I do, actually, yeah. I mean, I just think that he will... Well, whether it's sensible or not for him to do so is another matter. And that's, I mean, something that the Spurs medical staff will be monitoring. But we're knowing Harry Kane, as we've seen with England, and he has this reputation for the injuries that happen so regularly, particularly with the ankles. He always seems to come back slightly earlier than people imagined initially. Or maybe he's sensible. Maybe that's why they keep happening. But look, this is such an occasion. And he'll be looking at it thinking, God, I've got to be ready for the Champions League final, because it is Tottenham in the Champions League final. You know, who would have thought this was happening? But then also, he's got the following week, he's got the Nations League and a chance to lead his country into a tournament to
which
win.
Which is even bigger, of course.
Well, yeah.
Do you think that will be an afterthought? Because if you think, certainly will be.
No, I don't think it will.
What, for Liverpool and Tottenham players?
Not for those players, no. I genuinely think they're desperate to.
They are massively up for it.
Yeah.
They're really fired up for it. I think the timing is horrendous.
Yeah.
I mean, that basically now we've got two teams who supply a hell of a lot of England players.
Up to 10, exactly.
It's crazy. And, I mean, Gareth Southgate, what on earth can he do? Because basically he's got to pick those players. Yet by the same token, a lot of those players are kind of on the line, if you like, bearing in mind of carrying injuries, niggles, fatigue
coming
problems.
Coming back from injuries as well, yeah.
I mean, honestly, it's such a big ask for him. I bet he includes Harry Kane in the squad on Thursday.
He's doing it on Thursday. Do you expect any, not new names, but surprising or emerging names? What about Lewis Dunk at Brighton, who I thought has been terrific?
Oh, he's been fantastic. Dom's not quite...
I've seen Lewis Dunk the last few... in this run-in, and it's been a difficult time at Brighton, as we... probably discuss in a minute, but I think he's. And when you talk about leaders, Lewis Dunk has a reputation for being a leader. I don't think he's been that tub thumping leader that they needed him to be of late. They were brilliant in defending at Wolverhampton Wanderers, where they got a very crucial point, but they looked like little boys lost in a lot of the games up to that. Bournemouth at home, Cardiff at home. I mean, I witnessed it was an implosion that night. Seen as Cardiff's first goal. The first thing that went wrong for Brighton that night, there was no leadership out on that pitch. And that has ended up costing Chris Hughton his job. I'm not saying he should have demanded more of Lewis Dunk, because I think it's a strain on Dunk and Duffy in particular, because they were the rocks upon which that entire Brighton side has been built, maybe with Glenn Murray at the other end. But when they have their little... crisis of confidence, which they did have, there wasn't much else at that club, unfortunately. So I don't think Lewis Dunk has either shown enough on the international stage yet in his appearances for England, and I don't see him necessarily as a player that Southgate can lean on, even at where he might be short of centre halves.
I completely disagree. But there you go. So all about opinions.
Why? Why do you
think he's a I think he's a really powerful, strong centre-half. I think he's comfortable on the ball. I think, yes, I would agree, like a lot of players, you know, in Brighton's second half of the season, he probably suffered a bit. But actually, I think him and Duffy have been the ones that have kept them in the Premier League. And I think that they're basically some of their... But I mean, obviously, they give them such a base. And I think they're, you know, I think they're really good. And I think he is a... Yeah, I think he's a quality... centre-half. I think that basically I'd probably look at it and think it was a straight choice between him and Tarkowski. So I think that's the obstacle that he's up against, and maybe Tarkowski being in the squad a few times now basically might give him that edge, because I think if you look at it, the others are sort of well established, and you know, I think they're sort of, even Michael Keane's established, obviously. I think he's had a really good second half of the season. You know, John Stones.
Despite not playing that often.
Absolutely. And, you know, Joe Gomez will clearly be much more of a centre-half for England, you know, than right-back. Absolutely. He'll make a world of difference. And there's a good pool of players, basically, is what I'm trying to say. But I do think it's almost between Tarkowski and Dunk, and it's a very, very close call.
Mm. Well, as you say, Dunk's kept Brighton, or helped to keep Brighton in the Premier League. He didn't help to keep Chris Hughton in a job. Now, you were both there yesterday. I think we're all saddened when we see someone like Chris lose his job, because, you know, by common consent, he's a man of huge integrity and is also a pleasant man to deal with, you know, in the way that we do so. You were there. What was the mood music? Were you surprised to, you know, when this morning he was sacked?
I don't think we can judge anything from yesterday at all. I when I look at Chris Hughton and the mood around Brighton, I go back to, I did the Cardiff games and the Newcastle game, and there was discontent amongst the supporter base around that press box. They didn't expect to beat or get anything from Manchester City at home the last day. And in fairness, they actually played with far more enterprise in the first 20-25 minutes of that game yesterday than they have done a lot of the time this season. And it's been this sort of criticism of an overly conservative approach that has dogged Hughton. It dogged him at Norwich. It's dogged him in his latter days at Brighton. That said, he has performed the job that he was asked to do, which was A, to get Brighton, Well, first of all, actually, to save them from relegation from the Championship, then to get them into the Premier League, and then to keep them there. I don't know what else he could have done. It's dangerous to take that next step. I mean, as clubs, you have to time it right. When you want to be more progressive, when you want to be more expansive, when you feel you have a squad that is able to play a different kind of way and establish them at mid-table Premier League level. And I don't think, given the recruitment mistakes that have clearly been made at that club, most notably last summer when they spent an awful lot of money on players that haven't...
No return at all.
...at all, haven't come off. Mm. I don't think that's his fault. I don't think that's Chris Hughton's. Nothing to do with him. That's the recruitment department that let him down badly.
So it's just the old story of a club with ideas beyond its station?
Potentially, yeah. I mean, listen, I think they have got ideas, better ideas, I think. And whether that is above their station, we'll have to wait and see. But what has struck me over, and I have to say, I slightly disagree with Dom, simply because we've sort of had this discussion before, that at the end of his press conference, Chris Hughton, he just, I mean, he's such a nice guy, Chris. He's an absolute pleasure to deal with, as are Brighton, I have to say. Brilliant club to deal with. And basically got up at the end of the press conference and he basically just said a few words, basically. Thanks for all your support, guys. Really appreciate it. Been a sort of a pleasure dealing with you. And he then sort of, I felt, said something along the lines of, hopefully, but very pointedly, hopefully, see you next season sort of thing, really.
So I had the feel of a farewell
speech. I did, and then just...
I read it completely the other way. It's pretty weird.
Just as he left the room and he said, oh, kind of, you know, to us sitting over that side of the room, basically, what are you doing in the summer? And I just sort of said, yeah, more football. And he sort of then sort of said, yeah, football, and then basically I need something like, you know, I need a break from it all sort of thing. And I thought, And I just thought, but I must confess, you know, I didn't think they'd do it so quickly in terms of the next morning. And indeed, you know, I thought if they did do it, I thought they... I think where it's been unfair on him is that he's done such a good job, such a solid job. And yes, it hasn't been very good the last few weeks, and he'd admit that, I'm sure. But I think he's earned and deserved the right, if they do want to go to a different place, and I mean that with more homegrown signings, with better recruitment, then I think that he has done enough to warrant that opportunity to manage those players and take that club forward. Mm. If you can't see that, what a solid job he's done for Brighton. Brighton have never been established as a top-flight club. I don't care, you know, who says. Not in recent past. And he has... When we all picked our teams to be relegated and tips for the start of the season, I bet no one had Brighton going down. I just felt, and we probably might do, I grant you, next season, and that's a worry. But give him until October. That's my point. And then basically give him that opportunity to welcome those players in, make some squad changes. Yes, some of the players have not been good enough, but he deserved that right. And that's what I think the disappointment is.
I think we've all been around the block long enough to realise that the next man's probably in place. Mm. You look at Dan Ashworth, his sort of, you know, forgive the pun, his DNA is young, technically astute, empathetic head coach. Who do you think Brighton will be looking at and who do you think they'll get?
Well, we've been talking about it. Yeah. Well, basically, I think we're both of the view that basically, right, you know, if they've got a very short shortlist, right at the top will be Graham Potter of Swansea, who I think is sort of, you know, has done a decent job.
A very difficult, good job, yeah. In terrible circumstances.
Absolute difficult circumstances. And there's been a bit of frustration there. I'm sure that they'll lose a couple of players this summer as well. Mm. You know, obviously, Dan James being one. And then basically, I'm sure that job would appeal to him, you know, if he could move from the Championship to a club, which I have to say is still incredibly well run at Brighton and still looking to progress, then I'm sure he'd do that. I don't know that it's done as such, but I think that if all parties could agree, then maybe it's the most likely at this stage.
It's interesting that this has happened now and that, say, David Wagner took that Schalke job last week because... He was a figure that was talking about staying in the Premier League, wanting to stay in the Premier League, and I would have thought that would have been the type of fit that he would have liked coming into Brighton. Look, Brighton's We talk about above their station. Brighton have got a stunning stadium. They've got an even better training facility at Lancing. The basis is all there. They just need the team to sort of catch up. And whoever takes that job, albeit, as you say, they will appoint a head coach. The onus is going to go back just to recruitment. It's just on recruitment. They've got to get that right. They've got an ageing team. They're reliant upon a guy who's 35 scoring their goals. I mean, I love Glenn Murray to bits, but he is not. He's the wrong side of his mid-30s. It'll all boil down to that, and they have to get that right.
Do either of you expect any more Premier League managers to go in the next couple of weeks? Here's a case in point. I don't expect this to happen, but should it happen? Should Manchester United accept that they probably made a mistake and rectify that mistake?
The biggest single mistake that they've made, I think, was that in everything that they said and did in December, which was get rid of Jose Mourinho and bring in Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, was to say that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is highly unlikely to be the long-term manager. And basically, on the back of a remarkable winning run, particularly away from home, they're basically setting records, which, when you do that for Man United, it's got to be something special. Where I think they then basically made a terrible mistake and shows their naivety and the lack of leadership from above is to jump the gun, and having said previously they'll make a decision on it in summer, they got caught up in a wave of emotion and momentum, particularly on the back of Man United's remarkable win in Paris to get progress in the Champions League, and said, right, we're going to give Ole Gunnar Solskjaer the job. And they did it, during stroke at the end of the international break. And I just think that from that moment on, says everything you need to know about this group of players, which will ultimately, I think, let any manager down, not just Solskjaer. And that is fundamentally at the root of the problem, is that they switched off. They thought, oh, we've got the guy that we wanted in charge. Thanks very much. We'll take the foot off the gas. Results will tell you that's exactly what's happened. They've gone down the pan. They've missed out on an amazing opportunity to finish top four. They crashed out, obviously, not totally unexpectedly, out of the Champions League, and they switched off and they've let the manager down. Do they need someone stronger and more experienced? Yes. Should they do that now? Well, I have to say, I think that would be out of keeping with United's tradition, but they've really let themselves down by making that decision on a rushed basis and getting swept along by momentum. If you've got a really strong technical director or director of football, he says, no, we're going to leave it until the end of the season and then we'll make a judgment call. And I just feel that they've let the air out the balloon, basically, and it feels so, so flat. And I think that arguably making that brutal call would probably be the right call. But I don't know, in the grand scheme of things, whether United and their tradition and their DNA of giving legends a chance, I don't know whether that really fits. But that's me getting sort of a sucker for a good story and sort of a fairy tale appointment.
Sure. Some questions, actually, from the viewers and the listeners. Two, actually, on Manchester United. Vernon Grant asks, what one word would the panel use to sum up Manchester United's season? Mine would be lamentable. Is it time they put their trust in kids?
Panicked? Trust in kids? Well, if the kids are good enough, yeah, I guess. But unfortunately, they have a sort of strategy, if you can call it that, of bringing in stellar players who are to make a squad that is effectively just a group of individuals who are all almost playing for themselves. There's no, you look at City and what they've done, and they've got a system, you know, exactly what they're doing. Look at Liverpool, he's brought specifics in to improve the collective. It has worked. Nothing United have done in the transfer market has worked. In fact, when they got linked with Dan James, you look at that, the young winger of considerable talent, and you think, actually, that could be the first thing United have done right in the transfer market for some considerable time. Everything else is haphazard. There's another word, haphazard, do that. All shambles.
Yeah. I was going to say drifting, just because it feels like I was torn between drifting and mediocrity. Have I cheated there? I probably have. But
we'll forgive you, mate, don't worry.
I just cannot believe that Man United I mean, we used to think of Man United would always be in the top two. And now we think it's a struggle each year to be in the top four.
But we remember Liverpool in the early 90s, don't we? We what happened there, and it was almost a similar
cycles,
thing.
Yeah. But I just feel that Man United is this monster. They've got so much wealth, they've got so much marketing, they've got so much power that this really shouldn't be happening. They should be buying better. You know, they've got this amazing sort of tradition that still attracts.
Yeah. Paul Fry asks, Pochettino took over at Tottenham saying it was a 5-year project. Now they're in the Champions League final, top four again. How long will it take Manchester United to get back to that level? 5 years or more, assuming everyone else will improve this summer?
I think it will take 5 years, definitely. I think 5 years, if you can do it within 5 years, fantastic. But they need to completely rebuild. I mean, it's just you pick apart. There's worries over the goalkeeper. I think arguably they've got to let him go. You know, basically the right back. I was going to say the full backs. I mean, Luke Shaw has just been crowned Player of the Year. Probably it's not something that will fill him with. I'm sure it will, but sort of fill him with sort of particular pride because he's arguably been voted the worst. Sort of,
he's the least worst player.
Absolutely, you know, and fair play to him. He's done all right. So I'm not really looking to sort of, nail him. And basically, the centre halves have struggled. They've got Ashley Young playing for a large chunk of the season at right back. You know, he's so unfair on Ashley Young, who's always, I think, been very committed. He's not a fullback. He's playing out of position. And, people then absolutely rightly, crucify
him. Well, he's playing from memory, isn't he? That's
he is. I mean, he's just gone. You know, I do feel sorry for him. I think he's been a decent servant, funnily enough. He's never complained. And, midfield is an absolute mess. Up front, it's clear that Solskjaer doesn't really fancy Lukaku. And then basically he's gone to a different way. And Rashford, I think, is the one player who's maybe sort of still on an upward trajectory. But there's so many holes and so many errors within that squad. I just don't know where to start. So basically it's a long, long rebuilding process. But if you mention any player that's not within the sort of the top two or three in that particular bracket, the Man United fans go into complete meltdown, like you were saying about Dan James. And it's like, actually, you have to be realistic about this and say that if you are a top player, do you want to go to United at that stage? And Pochettino didn't buy his way or build that team on stellar signings, but he's really built that club up on intelligent signings.
So, final point. So, we're looking forward to the FA Cup final. I still think it's one of the great days. Who's going to win?
Watford. Because I said City would win two trophies this season, so I have to stick with them. I actually thought, it would be wonderful if there was a bit of romance right at the end of the season. So on that basis, I better have Aurelio Gomez scoring the decisive penalty in a shootout.
I think that City will win
logically.
It. I think City will win it.
Head says City, doesn't it?
Complete the treble or quadruple if you listen to Pep. But I think they've been the best team and they'll take a hell of a lot of stopping. But Watford would be the fairy tale. But I tell you what, if City do complete the treble, what an achievement. Yeah. What an achievement.
Yeah. Well, my mum watched only one game of football in her life. That involved Watford in the 1984 final. She sat next to Freddie Starr near the Royal Box. Watford lost that day and will probably do so again. Thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays.
Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.